Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today. We will stay sunny, looking for a high temperature right around 93. Should be clear tonight with lows around 70. And then a sunny, warm weekend with highs on Saturday and Sunday, both around 97 degrees. Currently with relative humidity at 13%, it's sunny and 87. And meanwhile, in Valley traffic, an accident I-10 eastbound at 7th Street blocks the shoulder, and the right lane is blocked in the 51 southbound at Thomas.
Health officials have confirmed two cases of measles in the state. Both individuals were associated with the private Eloy Detention Facility, which houses detainees from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. One of the individuals was an employee there, the other a detainee. There had been reports of a chickenpox outbreak at the facility, but Jessica Rigler with the Arizona Department of Health Services says that's still unclear.
It seems like clinically these cases were more compatible with chickenpox. However, because we know there's now measles in the facility, it's possible they could be measles. What we're doing is conducting some additional testing to see if we can get to the bottom of it.
Rigler says at least 9 specimens are currently being tested for measles. Those results could be available later today or tomorrow. Health officials say the employee who tested positive for measles may have exposed the public last Saturday at Harrah's Auction Casino in Maricopa and the Arco AM/PM store in Casa Grande on Sunday. Arizona officials say 6 meetings scheduled next month will allow the public to have a say in planning for the proposed Interstate 11 that would connect southern Arizona with northern Nevada. The State Transportation Department says it scheduled the meetings as it moves ahead with a 3-year environmental study for a corridor between Nogales on the U.S.-Mexico border and Wickenburg northwest of Phoenix. The department says the discussion topics for the meetings will likely include potential routes for the corridor, environmental considerations, and cultural resources.
The results of last week's special election are now official, but the controversy isn't over. Yesterday, Governor Doug Ducey accompanied Secretary of State Michelle Reagan, and they performed the official canvass of election results. But questions are still circulating about how the Secretary of State handled the election and whether Proposition 123, backed by Governor Ducey, is even legal. KJZZ's Will Stone was at the canvassing yesterday. Will, how did things go given all these concerns?
Steve, the canvass is a ceremonial event. It's really a photo opportunity. And in this case, it was a chance for Governor Ducey to celebrate his victory with Proposition 123. That was the ballot question that settled the state's ongoing lawsuit over education funding by using the state land trust to pour billions of dollars into public schools over the next 10 years. So Ducey, the Chief Justice, and of course, Secretary of State Reagan were all there. They signed the documents. They took the pictures. But immediately after, Reagan darted out of the room and the media followed. And really a question with her is how she handled the error that her office had, which led to about 500,000 voters not receiving their ballot guides far enough in advance of the election. It's been a controversy that really came up about a week before the election. Some people even said the election should be stopped because of it. That didn't happen, but the attorney general has said he's launched an inquiry into how Reagan's office handled it. So a lot of this is still unresolved.
So, well, what did Secretary Reagan have to say about the problem? What caused it?
All along, some of the criticism of Reagan has been that her office was slow to react and really acknowledge this problem. Eventually, when she did, she said it was a problem with the database that was built by the vendor, which was IBM. IBM has more recently said, well, no, it wasn't our fault. We weren't tasked with actually making sure you operated this correctly. And so after the attorney general came out very strongly and criticized Reagan, her office this week released hundreds of pages of emails and internal documents that show the confusion about operating this software. And also, part of the question is there were new employees in our office who weren't really familiar with it. So when there was an error, what do they do? And here's what she had to say.
But that doesn't mean that when new employees ask for instructions from a vendor, that they should get non-answers. And at the end of the day, I have said that this pamphlet error happened on my watch. I take responsibility for that.
Reagan said they have since gotten rid of the vendor and they moved on. But certainly there's still a lot of skepticism about these documents she's put out, partly because they came from her office and whether an independent kind of investigation needs to go forward as well.
So, well, what about Governor Ducey? He is celebrating Prop 123 as a victory, even as some critics are saying, well, hold on, this might be illegal.
That's right. Ducey was saying, you know, this is a victory for public schools and really settled this lawsuit that was hanging over our state. So he was all smiles during the ceremony and signing of the results. But and in reference to the Reagan issue, he pretty much said the election is over. She talked about that. Let's move on. But this week, State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt asked the Attorney General for an opinion about whether Proposition 123 is legal. He's been one of the most vocal critics of that, and he and others have maintained that perhaps it's not legal to take more money from the state land trust without congressional approval. And so people were saying to Ducey, you know, why hasn't this been resolved already? We've had these questions since October. He, however, counters that they have, you know, strong legal foundation to believe that this was totally okay. And this is what he had to say.
There's certain I's you have to dot and T's you have to cross. The first was today with the certification and a short celebration on the passage of Prop 123 and 124. We'll let that process move forward so we can get these dollars into the classrooms as soon as possible.
So how all this plays out, whether the Attorney General comes out with an opinion on this, and how soon the money gets into the classrooms, which is the big question, is still up in the air. But certainly the governor is confident that will happen.
KJZZ's Will Stone on the official passage of Prop 123 and its aftermath. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Arizona schools will see a change in how they get their letter grades in the next couple of years. Joining me with more on this process is Carol Schmidt, the Arizona Board of Education's executive director. And Carol, you're revamping the A through F grading system.
We are. In connection with the A to F school accountability system, it's been on a hiatus for the last couple of years because of the change in the statewide assessment. And there's been some changes in the law that allows more flexibility and for the board to consider measures beyond just test scores.
So what will change about the new system, do you think, than what the state had been using before the system sort of got frozen for a bit?
With the new system, part of what can go into the school accountability is additional, what's known as multiple measures, as well as college and career readiness indicators. So that's very different than the old system where we were pretty much limited to test scores.
Do you think that when parents look at a school's letter grade, they look at what went into making that grade, or they just see, oh, this school has an A or this school has a B or whatever it is?
When the school grading comes out under this new school accountability system, we anticipate that there'll be greater transparency about what goes into that letter grade, so there'll be greater information for the parents.
Do you anticipate that schools will see their grades affected by the new standards? I mean, do you think schools that were A schools, for example, might not be A schools anymore?
So in developing the A to F school accountability plans, there's a wide variety of things that go into whether or not a school gets a letter grade, whether it's an A, B, C, D, or F. And part of those are multiple measures, which can be a variety of different things of valid and reliable data that impact student academic progress. There'll be college and career readiness indicators. There'll be test scores. And all of these different components get different weights. And what'll happen before the final plan is adopted is there'll be a modeling process where they'll actually be created different models with different weights and different components, and then we'll finalize that and pick a final model. I would anticipate that schools that are doing well will continue to do well, and I think with the multiple measures, it'll give more opportunity for other schools to do well, too.
Traditionally, Arizona has had schools basically getting every letter grade. There's some A, B, C, D, and F schools. Under the new model, do you anticipate that there will still continue to be schools getting all of the different letter grades?
We do. Under the new model, we anticipate that there'll be a mix of letter grades. The big difference between the new model and the old model is that there's not that forced bell curve. So every school will have the opportunity to get an A.
What is a reasonable timeline, do you think, for the schools to go back to having A through F grades?
Well, we're hoping that we'll have a plan finalized by the fall. And then at the end of the 2016-2017 school year, then we'll have three data points to include in the new plan.
Carol Schmidt is the executive director of the Arizona Board of Education. Carol, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Jobs are on the increase in the Valley, but some economists and analysts are concerned about the kinds of positions that are growing here. The cover story of the latest edition of the Phoenix Business Journal takes a closer look at how many of those jobs are being filled by Arizonans and which hires are from out of state. Eric J. Toll covers the economy for the Business Journal and put together the story, which includes figures compiled by Indeed.com. Eric, where are these new employees in Phoenix moving from?
The Southwest and the West Coast, obviously, is big. Los Angeles, San Diego, Las Vegas, those were the big feeders into the market. But the interesting thing for me was the jobs that people were looking for, because you would expect people are coming here for aerospace or technology. They're coming for service jobs. And I'm not saying, well, I'm talking about advanced business services. I'm not talking about the call centers.
Is cost of living still a factor? For many years, that was something where people would say, well, it is less expensive to settle in Phoenix, maybe even start a business in Phoenix, so I'm going to go there. Is that still a major factor?
That is a factor among people who are looking to move here. Mm-hmm. I talked to one technology employee who came and is working for Double Dutch. He said that he was in San Diego and was looking for a job in San Francisco. And while the jobs in San Francisco paid extremely well, he realized he would still be living at the same scale he was when he was in college. And he looked around when he heard that Double Dutch was opening an office in San Francisco, from San Francisco to Phoenix. He decided to go after the job here, and he said he got a better job, he got a good salary, even though it wasn't as high as San Francisco, and he can live where he wants to.
But you also have a quote from him that I'm looking at right now that said, it was time to move to someplace exciting. And I can't remember the last time people actually said that, comparing Phoenix to San Francisco.
And that's interesting. Of the three CEOs I talked to in this past week, they said that Phoenix is a happening place. The downtown has a vibrancy to it. I interviewed the CEOs of a company that came out here earlier this year. And they were saying they were taking a walk at lunchtime through downtown, and they looked at each other and said, wow, this is like downtown Cleveland. Now, you hear that and you go, Cleveland? But what they were referring to was Cleveland has gone through this major renaissance downtown. It's become a hip focus, and businesses are moving back into the center city. We're seeing that in Phoenix as well.
Are more people who have settled here, or let's say graduated from college, whatever it may be, are we seeing fewer of those people leaving and deciding to say, you know, this is a growing place, maybe I can get a good job here, and then we're adding folks from out of town? Is Phoenix winning in terms of the net migration of jobs?
We are winning on net migration. Indeed.com actually runs what they call a net job score, mm-hmm. and Phoenix has a positive number, which means there are more people applying for jobs here than are applying for jobs elsewhere. The interesting thing on people moving in, cost of housing is the number one reason people were picking the Phoenix market. 48% of the people moving here are doing it for cost of housing. Moving out, the number one reason was family.
Eric J. Toll covers the economy for the Phoenix Business Journal. We've been talking about his cover story in the latest issue. It's called The New Immigrants, Where and Why Job Seekers Come and Go. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
As competition grows stiffer to create jobs in Arizona, and with big data becoming increasingly more important, the Center for the Future of Arizona and the Arizona Commerce Authority have responded by launching the Arizona Job Creation Progress Meter. The meter will include six indicators: net new jobs, unemployment rate, total exports, per capita income as a percentage of the national average, venture capital per capita, and educational attainment. In a few minutes, we'll hear from the president and CEO of the Arizona Commerce Authority. We start with Laddie Kaur, chairman and CEO of the Center for the Future of Arizona. Laddie, has this been a shortcoming in Arizona to not have had something like this job creation progress meter already?
It's not uncommon for states not to have a clear statement of the future, and certainly the kind of eight goals that we've discerned from the citizens is not replicated in many other states. There are varying degrees of information bases that states will use. I think it's only fitting that the steps that have led us to this moment are the steps that Arizona is ready for, has shown an interest in doing, and now, in fact, makes it something that can be used actively. So I don't think it's been, I don't think it's that different in other states to not have this kind of precision to measure what we're doing.
One of the indicators is educational attainment, the percentage of residents who completed a 2 or 4 year degree. Why should it be included here?
It's because other major organizations and activities nationally have said the single greatest measure of economic health in a state is the extent to which the population has an education beyond high school. That's where the future is, and that's where we're headed. All of the work we've done show that by 2020, 68% of the new jobs are going to require education beyond high school. That's why the companion progress meter, the first one that we issued just a few months ago, is on education, where you can see the stepping stones from the percentage of our students that are proficient at third grade reading, eighth grade math, the proportion of our high school students that complete high school, and the number that enroll in post-secondary education. It's not, by the way, just a 2 and 4 year degree. That's true in the definition we have for the jobs creation, but there are also certificates that industries approve that lead to a better job. So educational attainment has its own set of measures, but it is by general consensus the best way to assess what the potential is for strengthening the economy in the future.
Lattie Coor is chairman and CEO of the Center for the Future of Arizona, also former president of Arizona State. Lattie, thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
The Center for the Future of Arizona is partnering with the Arizona Commerce Authority on the progress meter, and Sandra Watson is president and CEO of the Commerce Authority. Sandra, how much can a tool like this do to generate more businesses moving here to Arizona?
So a tool like this begins to really describe the strengths of our economy through job creation in each one of the markets. This allows us to continue to emphasize those strengths and tell our success stories to not only businesses outside of Arizona, but also businesses within Arizona. So when we look at when we look at the progress meter, this is about job creation. So it's intended to help encourage job growth from existing businesses here in Arizona and also attract new businesses, creating new jobs and adding capital investment into our state. For example, the latest employment data released by the Arizona Department of Administration shows that private employers in Arizona added jobs at a rate of 3.7%, which is 75% higher than the national average. Also, our state had its largest export year ever in 2015, which is $22.56 billion, and that represents a 6.2% increase. The story behind those numbers is that there's tremendous activity here in Arizona. We are making progress, and in the case of exports, we were one of only 8 states to register growth in 2014.
How important is it to send a message to other businesses, other regional competitors, that Arizona is in some ways maybe upping its game? Can this be seen that way?
Absolutely. Not only can this be seen as Arizona upping its game, we are measuring progress. And so this is allowing us to identify gaps and develop strategies for continuous improvement. In addition to that, what it begins to communicate to businesses outside of our state, as well as within Arizona, is that the economic development community is united, and that we have a shared focus in how we're developing our strategies. And so
the economic development organizations, along with policymakers, are all working to strengthen the state's economy. And so we now have a collective opportunity to ensure that businesses are successful here in Arizona.
Is this a short-term and a long-term plan? How would you characterize it?
I would characterize it as an ongoing plan. It's important that we communicate what is happening within Arizona and how we can begin to advance the state's economy. Our goal at the ACA is to strengthen and diversify the state's economy through quality jobs and investment. This clearly has some long-term impact. The opportunity for us to come together and begin to focus our strategies and develop new programs and policies around some of the measures is an important aspect of growing our economy.
Sandra Watson is president and CEO of the Arizona Commerce Authority. Sandra, good to talk with you. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Phoenix has one of the highest rates of disconnected youth in the country. It's a term you might have heard lately because it's a growing problem nationwide. It describes 16 to 24-year-olds who are not in school and not working.
Not far from where we are, one in three of the young adults age 18 to 24 are disconnected. They're not in jobs. They're not in school. And that's a pretty significant population.
Kim Owens is the founding executive director of Year Up Arizona, a 12-month intensive training program that gives disconnected young people professional training and helps launch them into their careers.
There was a study done on some 900 cities in the country, and our South Phoenix area ranked seventh in terms of the highest disconnection rates. So in our own backyard, these 18 to 24-year-olds, what's keeping them from being successful and what's their barrier?
That's the question the City of Phoenix and Councilwoman Laura Pastor tried to answer when they conducted a new study to find out how engaged young people are in our city and what might work to draw them in. And the show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. Lauren, tell us a little bit more about the study.
Councilwoman Pastor's office surveyed almost 400 young people in Phoenix, as well as 40 parents, and they held 9 focus groups on this. And they found 40% of young people in Phoenix say they don't really feel connected to their community. Only 17% of the young people they surveyed said they have a job. And almost one of two of them said that they don't think they're being offered the opportunities they need to become engaged. And these disconnected youth were then less likely to be involved in school clubs or volunteering or other outside activities like music lessons or tutoring or being involved in their church.
So did the city look into what some of the barriers are for these young people?
They did, and I think this is one of the most interesting findings. The first and the biggest barrier young people reported was transportation. Phoenix isn't a city like New York or Chicago where public transportation can get you just about anywhere, and not having a car can make it really hard for someone to get to a job or to school on time here consistently. So I talked to Martin Whitfield about the study. He's the coordinator of the City of Phoenix's My Brother's Keeper program. It's an initiative started by the Obama administration to create opportunities for young men of color, and he helped carry out the study.
Some of the barriers were home responsibilities. You know, a lot of the kids mentioned that they were taking care of their younger siblings. School involvement was another barrier for them. And then the one that kind of concerned our organization is they didn't know about a lot of the programs and didn't have access to them.
And they were really surprised by this, that their message wasn't getting out there, basically. So he said the Parks Department and city management are working on beefing up their marketing and outreach.
So what makes Phoenix so far toward the bottom on this list?
Well, there are a lot of factors that go into this. Here's Kim Owens again with Year Up Arizona.
You have to look at factors like youth employment rates. You have to look at the overall employment rates. You look at education attainment and the levels to which the community is educated.
And in Phoenix, those rates aren't so good. Less than 30% of adults here have at least a bachelor's degree, compared to more than 40% in a place like Boston. School enrollment is less than 60%. One in five young people is unemployed. And our poverty rate in Phoenix is more than 17%. And Owens says disconnected youth is not a new problem, but it's gotten worse recently.
I think anytime there's poverty, there is a disconnected population. A disconnected population, meaning youth mirror those adults who are around them. And in 2007 to 2010, we added about 1 million disconnected youth into our population. We did that when the Great Recession hit, and it hit that age group hardest when it came to employment.
And she says it's just now that we're starting to see the needle move in reducing this population of disconnected youth.
So, Lauren, what does the city want to do to try to combat this disengagement that they found in the study?
So the city says the study's findings call for investment in activities, access to technology, and programming. They're reinstating $200,000 in funding for programs and services for disconnected youth in next year's budget that Whitfield says will go to the Parks Department, to adding technology, and they're planning to buy these mobile units that can go to city parks and centers with things like video games and fitness activities, arts programs. Free Wi-Fi is an important one.
So a lot to come. Lauren Gilder. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Steve.
Bullying can get pervasive in schools if left unchecked, and the antidote is not one size fits all. Some schools try to bring in guest speakers, and some reward kids for good deeds.
There are even apps now that try to help schools and parents discover bully behavior. Setup is easy, but as the show's Annika Klein tells us, an app is only as helpful as the people who download it.
The most popular apps let us message our friends, watch videos, and reach that high score.
Sweet.
Jacob DiMartino's app reports bullies.
Students have the capability to upload images and video content as supplemental material to their in-app reports, all with the flexibility to submit reports anonymously, which is a big deal.
It's called Bully Radar. It was released earlier this month. DiMartino lives in the Valley, and by next school year, he hopes this app will be in the hands of students. They report what they see, and that information gets sent to school officials.
We plan on enhancing the administrator side of this to allow school administrators to better analyze what incidents occur.
And with no financial cost to students or schools, DiMartino believes this will be an easy upgrade to the reporting tools that exist in schools now.
If problems become very serious, students may use this form to file a complaint if they believe one or more of the following has occurred.
Phoenix Unified High School District lets students and staff know about a form they can fill out to file a complaint about bullying. And Tempe Union High School District has a phone line where students leave a voicemail that becomes an email alert. But for any of these reporting tactics to work, people have to use them, and use them correctly.
You can't mechanize human contact.
Brad Snyder is the director of the Dion Initiative at Arizona State University, which focuses on bullying prevention.
So there is nothing that is going to take the place of a caring adult actively involved in the life of the child.
There are a lot of tools that deal with anti-bullying. Snyder says they're great if you know what to do with them.
But then if the faculty doesn't know what to do when a student brings an incident to them, if the students aren't given clear instruction and kind of left to figure it out on their own, then a lot can fall apart.
As if it weren't already hard enough to say, hey, I'm being bullied. A broken or non-existent reporting system can make it impossible.
I knew what was happening to me, and I just didn't tell anybody because I was scared and I didn't want to lose friends.
Julia Rivas went to a private school in fourth grade. She's in sixth now. She was bullied there for months. Some girls took her lunch away because they said she was too fat and she shouldn't eat. It took a while for Julia to tell anyone. Then, when she and her mom told administrators, it was brushed off.
I felt like I was just thrown away. And so at that point, I kind of regretted telling because I thought somebody would have done something if I told, but they didn't.
Brad Snyder says the first step in bully prevention is encouraging all students and staff to look out for each other. And it's in that kind of an environment where an app could work.
An app like this is going to be more useful to bystanders. So not to the victim as much as it is to somebody else that's seeing it happen and giving them an easy avenue to get involved and to intervene on behalf of somebody else.
Julia's at a new school now. She says she would feel much more comfortable there, going to her teachers if anything happens.
I know that now in myself that if anybody ever was mean to me again, I would know to stick up for myself.
No matter how many new tools there are to fight bullying, it still takes courage to use them. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
Hey, did you know there's a podcast of the show? Yeah, just download the KJZZ app for your phone, swipe the bottom toolbar to get podcasts, and there you can hear the show, KJZZ's Here and Now, and who knows, maybe even some new podcasts. It's all on the KJZZ mobile app. Check it out.
In KJZZ News, legislation consolidating the Arizona Geological Survey into the University of Arizona provides no funding for the state agency to continue its work. As KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, the new arrangement could also result in layoffs.
State geologist Lee Allison has warned 8 employees at the Arizona Geological Survey that unless different financial arrangements are made, they could lose their jobs by the end of June. At that point, the Geological Survey will close its Phoenix office and move all of its operations from the state office building in Tucson to an office with half the space located on the University of Arizona campus. A budget bill passed by the legislature transferred the duties of the Arizona Geological Survey to the U of A, but there was no appropriation for the survey to continue its work, and the U of A is expected to pick up the tab. Allison says despite neither the survey nor the university asking for the consolidation, they're trying to work out a compromise.
We're trying to hammer out ways to maintain our services without impeding on the university's mandate to provide tuition support and education.
The university is committed to matching the survey's state appropriation of $941,000 for 1 year, but the rest of its budget, about 50%, comes from grants and contracts, and the new consolidation would affect that revenue as well.
What we're looking at is losing a lot of the grant fund overhead, which we've used to subsidize the operations, and the potential that a year from now, we're going to have to be 100% on grant money.
The Geological Survey provides services used by the mining industry, the real estate industry, and local government planning groups, in addition to running the state seismic monitoring network. Allison says they may have to start charging fees for those services. He hopes to get a line item for the Geological Survey in the state budget next year. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A former border vigilante on trial for sex crimes is expected to testify in his own defense next week. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Matthew Casey reports.
Chris Simcox is a founder of the Minuteman Movement, was a candidate for U.S. Senate, and a former elementary school teacher. He's representing himself against charges that he sexually abused young girls. The state rested its case on Tuesday, but the county attorney's office says the defense has been, quote, disorganized with its witnesses, and there was only 45 minutes of testimony on Wednesday and Thursday. During opening arguments, Simcox promised the jury he'd testify, argued that he'd been targeted for his political beliefs, and said he was, quote, really angry about being falsely accused. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Pima County has won a lawsuit against the state over Arizona shifting a tax burden onto the county. Andrea Kelly is a reporter for Arizona Public Media in Tucson and has covered the story. So, Andrea, what's the issue behind the suit?
The state in 1980 actually limited the amount of property tax any residential homeowner can pay. It limited it to 1% of the home's assessed value. And when you combine county taxes, school district taxes, city property taxes, fire taxes, all the different taxes that any individual property is responsible for, obviously sometimes you could exceed that 1% cap. What was happening in several counties was when that 1% cap was exceeded, the state was paying the difference and it was going to school districts. In 2015, the state shifted that payment for the more than 1% taxes to Pima County and Pinal County. It stopped paying that difference in taxes for school districts, so the counties became responsible for paying the school districts those differences, and Pima County had to raise its property taxes.
So was Pima County having to make up that difference even though it itself was not responsible entirely for the difference that greater than 1%?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's not that Pima County was solely responsible for the excess, but Pima County was being forced to pick up that difference instead of the state.
So how much did property taxes go up in Pima County?
Well, the overall Pima County budget has estimated the impact to be between $8 million and $18 million every year. And for the coming fiscal year, Pima County was looking at a tax increase even more than that to cover what the state is passing along to counties now. And that includes other cost shifts that the counties have bemoaned from the state in other previous years as well.
Does the county have an estimate as to what the average household would have had to pay?
For the coming fiscal year, the one that will begin on July 1st, the county was looking at about a $27 increase for the average homeowner. So, and if you look back to last year, it was about the same as well.
So with this ruling, does Pima County anticipate putting its property taxes back where they were before?
Well, there's a question about what would happen with the taxes that have been assessed for the current fiscal year, so those tax bills that have already been paid. But for the next fiscal year, the one that begins July 1st, The county was considering a property tax increase to cover those state costs, and the county administrator has said he would not suggest raising taxes at all if the state hadn't passed along this cost. So essentially for next year, it would be a neutral instead of a decrease or an increase.
And I would imagine that county officials are probably pretty excited about that.
Yes, I talked with the chair of the Board of Supervisors, Sharon Bronson, on Tuesday, and she said it's very exciting, but she also said it's bittersweet because the state has passed along other costs that the county still has to pick up and other counties are still picking up. The only question really remaining, though, is whether the state's going to appeal this decision. And if it does, then this is still an on-running litigation, and it leaves the county with a bit uncertainty about what it should do or what it will do, whether there could be a question of refunds, whether it should start with a lower tax rate and make up for it if it loses in a higher court.
Andrea Kelly is a reporter with Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Andrea, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Mark.
Arizona residents have to earn more than $17 an hour to afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment. The state's minimum wage is $8.05 an hour. And according to a new report, that means there are a lot of Arizonans struggling to find affordable housing. Andrew Arend is vice president for research with the National Low Income Housing Coalition, which put out the study called Out of Reach. It looks at the gap between what rental housing costs and what people earn. And Andrew, what did you find overall?
Across the country, on average, we found that in order to afford a modest two-bedroom rental unit, someone would have to earn $20.30, and that's working full-time, 40 hours a week for 52 weeks out of the year. And the housing wage for a one-bedroom rental unit was $16.35 an hour. If someone's working at the federal minimum wage of $7.25, they'd have to work 90 hours a week just to afford a one-bedroom apartment at the national average.
It looks like in Arizona, the average hourly wage for a two-bedroom apartment is considerably lower than the national one, just a little more than $17, so about three bucks less. And the number that you put Arizona right at, basically in the middle of the country, 24th most expensive. What specifically did you find about the situation here in Arizona?
So the two-bedroom housing wage, and this is the statewide average, it was $17.18 for a modest two-bedroom apartment, and for a one-bedroom, it's $13.61, which you're right, is slightly below the national average. But what we find is that incomes often are also related to housing costs. So if we look at really expensive housing markets or really expensive states like California, incomes also tend to be a little bit higher. And so then when we go to a state like Arizona, where it looks as though the housing wage is lower, which it is, incomes also tend to be a little bit lower as well. And so when we look at lower wage employees or lower wage workers, there's still an affordability gap because incomes also tend to be a little bit lower.
We've talked in the past about how the apartment market is really doing well here, especially in the Phoenix area, and there are a lot of new apartments, a lot of new units coming online, but they tend to be pretty high-end, luxury-type places, and there's not a lot of new construction for folks making less money. Did you find that there is an availability problem in Arizona?
There is. So the rental market in recent years, the demand for rental housing has been at historic levels for a number of reasons. And the market is starting to respond at the higher end of the market, but not at the lower end, predominantly because it's difficult to develop housing that's affordable to lower wage workers and support the development and operating costs of that housing. We do a report every year on the gap. We call it the gap, but really it's trying to calculate what is needed to serve the lowest wage or the lowest income renters. And for Arizona earlier this year, we found that there's a shortage of about 151,000 affordable and available rental units for those lowest income renters.
Is that number high relative to other states?
The states where extremely low-income renters face the greatest difficulty, Arizona is one of those states. When we look at the number of units that are affordable and available to extremely low-income renters, and then the number of extremely low-income renters, in Arizona, we find that there's only 21 rental units for every 100 extremely low-income households. In terms of difficulty in finding affordable housing, Arizona is one of the worst states.
Andrew Arend is Vice President for Research with the National Low Income Housing Coalition. We were talking about the coalition's report called Out of Reach, which was released earlier this week. We'll post a link to it at theshow.kjzz.org. Andrew, thank you very much.
Great. Thanks a lot, Mark.
This month, the Washington Post published the results of a survey it conducted, finding 9 out of 10 Native Americans are not offended by the Washington Redskins name. That drew an angry response from, among others, the Native American Journalists Association, or NAJA, which said the reporting, quote, failed to pass the test of accurate and ethical reporting and attempts to, quote, legitimize a defined racial slur. For more on this, I'm joined by Patty Talahungva. She's a journalist and past president of NAJA. She's also Hopi. And Patty, what was your first reaction when you saw the story in the Post?
When I first saw that poll, when I first saw the headline, my whole stomach just twisted up. And I thought, how is it possible in 2016 that a paper that has such a great reputation for investigative journalism would even consider polling a racial slur to see if people thought it was okay? How does that happen? And why did they just choose that one racial slur? Why not a bunch of other racial slurs that are out there? What about the N-word? Why don't we poll that and see what people say? Is that okay? Because people certainly use that word. I have been Native American all my life, and I have never had another Native person call me a Redskin. And if they did, I would not accept it.
One of the concerns that it seems that NAJA had with the poll was this idea of respondents were asked to self-identify whether or not they were Native American or not. Is that a concern that you share?
Absolutely, because there's no, there's so many things about that question. Who is a Native American? And yes, you self-identify, but it's also a learned and it's a lived experience of being Native American. So for example, somebody who is born and raised on the reservation, as opposed to somebody who lives in an urban area, how do they identify? I know people who are full-blooded Hopi Indians, but are so removed from the culture and the lived experience, they only know that they're Hopi and that's it. But that's their experience. So for them to say, oh, I don't think this term is derogatory or a racial slur or anything like that, is very different from somebody who lives on a reservation or who has strong ties to their native culture.
What kind of impact do you think this survey and sort of the discussion that follows it may have on the whole debate over what to do with the Washington football team?
That's the sad part. That is the really sad part because, again, people are going to be waving this poll around and saying, oh, look, Native Americans are not disgusted by this. They're not upset by this. It's used as evidence. And yet the evidence is so shaky.
The evidence, though, I mean, the poll found that it wasn't a small majority. It was 90% of the people who responded said that they didn't have a problem. And that's not just a sampling error.
Oh, it is. It is. Again, you have to go back to who's my source? Who is saying this? And what motive do they have for saying this? So I understand that we have a lot of other issues that we need to be concerned about. Healthcare is a huge issue in Indian country. Housing is a huge issue. And a whole host of medical issues. But this starts at the very basic. This starts at childhood.
Well, given your concern about the effect of this poll and the results, what can organizations like NAJA, what can individuals like yourself do to try to, I guess, counter it and to try to make sure that people know that, hey, not all Native Americans are okay with this?
Well, we've been very active on social media. So, and also NAJA has taken a stand on this issue years ago and issued a Reading Red report and has called on news organizations to stop using the term. So that's one way. I think the other way is to, again, get back on social media and let the team know and let the fans know that this is not acceptable.
Why is it that there has been such a furor over this one team, and you don't really hear anything about calls for the Atlanta or Cleveland Major League Baseball teams to change their names, not to mention the countless college and high school and other teams that have names that I would imagine, as a Native American, you wouldn't be all that thrilled with?
This goes back to, what is your community? Maybe not in your community, you know, you don't see this issue being raised, but in my community, which is a very large Native American community, those are also issues. You know, we're not letting other teams get away with this. Absolutely. When we look at something like the Chiefs or the Braves, those are not racial slurs. But what happens with the promotion of that mascot, you have people dressed up in whatever they think is Indian. And that's just wrong.
Patty Talahangva is a journalist and past president of the Native American Journalists Association. Patty, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
No state has embraced solar energy quite like California. It's the leading market with enough solar to serve more than 3 million homes. And by 2030, the state aims for half of all its electricity to come from renewables. But these days, that clean power is increasingly going across state lines to Arizona. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
It's just after lunchtime on the trading floor of Arizona Public Service in downtown Phoenix, and three guys are chasing deals.
If there's another utility that can produce power for the next hour cheaper than what we can out of our own power plants, we'd like to buy that power from them.
Imagine a blowout sale when, for a couple hours, you're actually paid to take stuff. That's Arizona's energy situation with its next-door neighbor, California.
And that's very typically what happens every day during this time of year.
It's a mild, sunny spring day across the Southwest. Customer demand is low, but solar panels are churning out lots of power, so much that California has a surplus and needs to incentivize other states to take some. It does this through negative pricing. Right now, it's minus $7 per megawatt hour. But later today,
when everyone goes home from work and turns on their TV, cooks their dinner, and all that kind of stuff, we typically see power prices in that evening peak period being somewhere around $30 to $40 per megawatt hour.
It's a big fluctuation, says Albert, and a relatively new phenomenon. For now, that's good news for APS customers.
But we're a little limited because we have so much solar in our system, too.
This is the warning utilities are sounding about the advent of solar, from commercial farms to small rooftop systems. It's an intermittent resource and doesn't always match demand.
A lot of people think of this as a problem.
That's Jim Bach with the nonprofit Vote Solar.
We think of this as actually a real indication of how far solar has come in terms of price and availability.
Bach calls this negative pricing growing pains of an industry that's in many ways still stuck in the last century.
We see this as new technologies and renewable clean resources that have become very, very cost effective being put onto a grid that was designed under a very different structure.
Traditionally, utilities owned every step of the process, from generation to distribution. Nowadays, solar power floods the grid, even when demand is low. And Bach says utilities need to adapt. That means scrapping old power plants that aren't flexible and can't be backed down. But consumers will also be a part of the new grid, he says. For example,
I'm going to generate from my solar and either charge my electric vehicle or I'll charge a battery, and then I can actually sell that back to the utility when the utility needs it most.
This transition is already underway, says Bach. Mark Rothleder is with the California Independent System Operator, which manages the state's excess energy. Speaking like only a grid operator would, he says the situation is manageable for now.
As we increase our renewable output, we do expect that the oversupply condition will increase in frequency and potentially in magnitude.
Rothleder explains paying Arizona to take power is often more cost-effective than shutting down large-scale solar farms, but it's not sustainable.
And that's why we're looking at things like energy and balance market or regional opportunities to exchange and share this energy when it's mutually beneficial for other parts of the system.
And Arizona is joining that new energy imbalance market later this year. It's a sophisticated system that allows utilities across the West to balance demand in short intervals. That'll help deal with the oversupply and could eventually save APS from $7 to $18 million annually. Back on the trading floor, Brad Albert says better integrating renewables is critical because
at stake is the reliability of the grid.
A grid that most people, whether you produce your own energy or not, still need to be reliable. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.